I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tom Hawthorne joins me again. The award-winning journalist and author has a new book out, and it's just terrific. The Year Canadians Lost Their Minds and Found Their Country, the Centennial of 1967. It's a book replete of lovely writing. He's cultivated a lot of marvelous anecdotes, history, and colorful characters that made this a remarkable year and such a defining year for Canada and its peoples. 50 years later, we still live in the shadow of the centennial. There are monuments and buildings, music and lore and more. Our sense of ourselves can be traced to that year when Canadians embraced their identity and cast off the indifference of what it meant to be Canadian. The centennial year culminated with Expo 67, held in Montreal. Young Tom Hawthorne went to Expo and shares some of his experiences in this book, as well as outlines just how big an event this was for the country. Tom Hawthorne's work has appeared in such publications as Reader's Digest and Canadian Geographic. He has regularly contributed to the Globe and Mail since 1984. His previous book, Deadlines, Obits of Memorable British Columbians, was published in 2012, and it was around that time that he first appeared on this program. The website for more is at tomhawthorne.blogspot.ca. The Twitter handle is at Tom Hawthorne. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program from here in Vancouver today, Tom Hawthorne. Mr. Hawthorne, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, nice to talk to you again. So I was telling you just before we started, I love this book. I'm not, I'm 35, so I obviously wasn't around in 1967. But you do such a marvelous job at showing us these different aspects of Canadian life in that year, whether it be sport, politics, cuisine, music, that it makes you feel nostalgic for this time and place.
You know, that's nice of you to say. Pierre Burton described 1967 as the last good year,
mm-hmm.
and in some ways it was. We were still innocent in 1967. Across the border, the border towns of Detroit and Buffalo had lots of racial strife that year.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like the United States was starting to become unglued in the fight over the Vietnam War. And in Canada, we had a different year. The centennial was being celebrated, and Canadians, for the first time, were taking a look at themselves and saying, "Well, who are we, and what have we got here, and what is it worth? what does it mean?" And mostly, Canadians liked what they saw. So it was a happy year for many people.
And you were just a kid, so as a historian, to go back, you can sort of look at these 3 years, 66, 67, and 68. The Canada that was in 66 was very different than the Canada that emerged in 1968, right?
Yeah, that's the conceit of the book. As an amateur historian reading contemporary accounts and interviewing people, I think the Canada of 68 is a brand new country. We've changed. In part, even the political culture has changed. Pierre Trudeau was elected Liberal leader and becomes Prime Minister, the first real Prime Minister that we've had that kind of stuck us on the world stage in a lot of ways. And I don't think he even gets considered as a leadership person if the crazy year of 1967 doesn't take place. So with Trudeau and that era of federal Liberals, Canada changes its immigration policy. In 1967, in fact, after this long, much to Canada's great shame, family members of ethnic Chinese were not permitted to freely immigrate and the like. And we start changing that after opening our doors to the world as visitors. In 1967, I think Canadians had a different take on their place in the world stage. And it's just hard to imagine the Canada of today without the year 1967 taking place.
Well, what compelled Canadians to mark this 100th anniversary of the country so enthusiastically? I mean, it really was a civic occasion where everyone took part and they were encouraged to do so by the government. I mean, it must have cost a lot of money, did it?
It did. And in fact, it's an interesting, going back, one of the things I learned and did not know, I was too young at the time, and you don't really see accounts of it. So this was a government initiative originally. There was a fellow named John Fisher, our famous radio broadcaster at the time, known as Mr. Canada for his work during the war and afterwards. And he'd long been canvassing that Canada should have a big celebration. And the federal government decided to do so. Originally, the plan started with John Diefenbaker and the Conservatives, and then the plans were then inherited by Lester Pearson and the Liberals in those great political fights of the early 60s. And it was all top down originally. It was all coming from the government down. And Canadians weren't interested. The papers are filled with accounts of Canadians saying, why are we doing this? It's not going to work. It's going to be foolish. The world's going to laugh at us. Nobody cares. What's a Canadian? It is amazing to see the negativity. And one of the things it reminds me of, there was a famous Alice Munro story titled, Who Does She Think She Is? The kind of the tall poppy syndrome, mm-hmm. like, why does somebody think they're special?
Yeah.
We'll knock them back a few notches. And there was so much of that. The Centennial logo is unveiled, and people say it looks stupid. The Centennial coins are released, and people are quoted, people in the street saying, why did they do that? Why are they these animals? Why don't they have these other things? And the negativity is really striking. But what happens in the early days of 1967, there's a couple of TV specials broadcast by CBC, including the Lighting the Centennial Flame on Parliament Hill on New Year's Eve with the Queen's message.
Right.
And then the following day, a really great program of entertainment, the highlight of which, although nobody wrote about it at the time, was Gordon Lightfoot, the folk singer, debuting, Canadian Railroad Trilogy, which runs for 8 minutes on the show and is, an instant classic.
Yeah.
And I think, and then the song Canada by Bobby Jimby was released with children's choirs in English and in French. And it just kind of imbues the people with the spirit. And so what happens is the government has spent a lot of money and they've offered a lot of money for projects, and it just takes off. People kind of go crazy. Little towns have special centennial events. People take on centennial projects of their own. There's a spirit that year that is quite something to behold. And I certainly felt it as a boy growing up in Montreal. I was just 7 years old.
Yeah.
Expo was in Montreal, and it was just a thrilling summer. You would see people on the streets, and you would see them on the streets, and you'd say, or on the fairgrounds even, at Expo 67, you say, oh, those people must be from Africa. I've never seen anybody from Africa before. Or, those people are Soviets. I've never seen a communist before. You know, because the whole world had come.
Yeah.
And it was quite a special event. And once the people, as a mass, decided to do their centennial things, I think that's where the great, true, fun spirit of it all came out.
Yeah, so when you can just look on a map or brochures across the country, and, you know, there are buildings in this town, named Centennial.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of those are from that year, right?
Absolutely. Centennial High School, Centennial Parks, Centennial Hospitals. Every capital city of every province got a special building built. And in British Columbia, it was the Royal BC Museum. There was tons of stuff built to mark Centennial. A lot of it government initiatives, but at all three levels of government. You know, municipalities did things, and provincial governments had building projects, and then the federal government was responsible for the overall party and for these projects in the capital cities. But a lot of people just did things on their own without spending any money at all or spending their own money just to see the country. It was a very common thing that year for people to get in the car and drive to Expo, with money. Just load up the family and let's go.
And then a lot of people walked across the country too, right?
Yeah, there's a crazy guy in my book. He's not really crazy, maybe a bit eccentric.
Yeah.
Named Hank Gallant, who was a laborer from Prince Edward Island working in British Columbia, and he just decides, he takes it upon himself that he wants to see the country that he loves. And so he dips a foot into the water off Beacon Hill Park in Victoria in February, and he heads north on the Trans-Canada Highway, and then he heads east. And he has some very close calls in the Rockies where he comes close to freezing to death. Bad decision on his part, because the February in Victoria is totally unlike March in the Rocky Mountain passes. And he eventually makes it all the way across country. It takes him 8 months, and he arrives in St. John's, Newfoundland on his 25th birthday and dips his toe into the Atlantic in St. John's Harbor. And there you have it. There's Hank Gallant. Then promptly forgotten. Nobody's paid attention to him since.
Well, when you look back at all this, because you're doing it through a lens of 50 years, or around 50 years, do you get a sense of the sort of what Canadians were looking for in terms of defining themselves and what sort of conclusions they came to about who they are?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I'm not sure there is a definitive answer to that.
Yeah.
Just in the same way, I'm not sure there's a definitive answer to what Canada is now, what to be Canadian means. My theory is that we're a flawed land, and we know it. But at the same time, we've evolved to have, usually through negotiation and compromise, to have a pretty good society. Still with some serious problems that need to be addressed, but for the most part, avoiding the strife that you see so commonly in the rest of the world. I'm taken aback when I look at so many of the projects that people took, how geography defines us, that we face both geography and climate. We face this very harsh climate and in a very large place where we're sparsely settled for the most part, and we're very far apart, and how people sought to bridge that, even physically. You know, Hank Gallant's walk across country, the most notable example. And the words that always, it's a cliche to have described Canada as the peaceable kingdom, but it is in many ways that's the case. And I think especially in contrast to the United States as it started to descend into the horrible strife that it would have in 1968, there were hints of it in 67, that I think Canadians just had a conviction that whatever it is that makes us slightly different from our dear friends and good cousins to the south, it's worthwhile. You know, it's I think Canadians were surprised. They invited the world to come to Expo 67. The world came, liked Canada, liked what they saw. And I think, I don't know if Canadians thought that that might be the response. I think many Canadians thought it would all be a flop and that we couldn't, that we weren't a big enough or an interesting enough place to pull it off. But in the end, we did.
Yeah. So it did. It worked sort of as a PR exercise in defining Canadians to the wider world.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a way to put it for sure. And the world paid attention for the first time. I've always thought Canada's one of the great accomplishments of Canada, this member of the Commonwealth. It was in the Second World War where, you know, my grandfather went off to northwestern Europe and fought the Nazis and helped defeat this evil power in the world. And but after the war, Canada makes a conscious decision to disarm and not have a large standing army. We had the third largest navy in the world at the end of the Second World War, and we decide to disband that. Uh-huh. We have an opportunity to develop nuclear weapons, and we say, actually, we don't want any part of that. And then as the war histories were written, the British and American historians just simply paid no attention to Canada. And people slightly older than me, that generation, weren't taught very much about Canadian military history and our role in the Second World War, which was quite an important one. And so Canadians just didn't see themselves reflected in anything. There were no Canadian songs on the national pop charts, so no Canadian music. There were no Canadian movies to be seen in the theaters. I mean, that Canadian filmmaking really didn't exist. And even Canadian literature, which has always been a strong point, the first Canadian Literature Studies program was started at UBC in the early 60s. And the response from the other universities and institutions was to say Canada had no literature, that we were a colony and we only had British literature or later American literature. And so there was, it's hard to imagine that now, to think that that Canada was so poorly regarded, even amongst ourselves, that we thought we didn't exist as a country, that there was nothing special about being Canadian. And so I think the whole year was kind of this odd, tentative step into seeing, well, what the heck does that mean?
Yeah. So Expo 67 is this event that I guess is the big party for the country. And as you said a moment ago, people would come to Montreal and celebrate there, people from outside of the country and people from all over the country. And so you were living in Montreal, you grew up in Montreal, and so for you and your family, I mean, as a seven-year-old kid, this was a big deal, wasn't it? You wanted to go, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, I have drawings at home where I've drawn the pyramids. The pavilions. When a little kid, you draw, you know, sports athletes or things like that, and I would also draw the pavilions. Just watching them build Expo over the previous two summers was beyond exciting. You can see off in the distance there's the famous, it still stands, the U.S. Pavilion, which was the Buckminster Fuller's geodesic dome, made of glass, a big round sphere. And then you could see it from certain vantage points downtown Montreal looking out on the islands. Then there was a tower with the British Pavilion with the Union Jack. And it was literally as if both Disneyland, which we watched every night on TV, every Sunday night on TV, we watched the Disney program, and Beatlemania, which we could hear on the radio, was just, you know, going to be one metro stop away. Like, you just could not wait for Expo to open. And my family did not have a lot of money, and my dad saved up a bit, and so we only were able to afford for one day for the family of four, and I'll never forget it. I remember going there. I remember what we ate. I remember the few pavilions we managed to get in because of the big lineups, and it was really exciting. Other people, you know, and the fare was not particularly expensive. It was quite reasonable, but lots of people got season passes, and that would give you a real passport. You could have a passport with your photo in it. And each pavilion would then stamp your passport. And as I've toured the book across country, people have brought their passports to show me, which is really wonderful.
Yeah.
People have kept these things for 50 years. So it was, you know, it was, and I think even that part of it, you know, the issuing of passports to ordinary people at a time when very few Canadians had a passport.
Yeah.
You didn't need one to get to the United States. And very few people could afford to travel overseas. That was just the start of that kind of the jet era,
yeah,
where you could fly overseas, and it was not cheap. So I think, you know, that following from 1967 in through to today, through the next 50 years, the young Canadians who go hit the world's paths with a backpack and a maple leaf sewn on their back, I think they owe a lot as well to the experience of young people in Montreal carrying around passports at Expo 67.
What's the figure in terms of the number of people that went to Expo 67 there in Montreal?
Yeah, I believe it's 55 million visitors, but that would include somebody who went every day.
Yeah.
So they would be counted, you know, the 150 days or whatever it was that the fair was open. It was open from April 28th to first week of October. So there were a lot of people came up, a lot of Americans came up in particular. There was a heavy advertising program in the United States to lure Americans north. Canada had a float in the Rosedale Bowl parade on January 1st, 1967, indicating centennial. You know, Macy's in New York had a big sign up in downtown New York talking about Expo 67, and there were advertisements in the magazines. One of the more clever ads was posted. It showed the Soviet pavilion, which was quite grand, quite beautiful. And the headline was, "Look at what the Soviets are building just 40 miles from the U.S. border. You should check it out." And so that was a very clever ad. So, you know, there's over 25 million Americans came up.
Yeah.
And for many of them, their first experience of Canada and certainly of Quebec.
How did this event in Montreal, how did that compare to, say, the Olympics in 76 or the Olympics here in 2010, or even Expo 86 here in Vancouver?
Yeah, I would say it. The experience of people who were at all those other events would be somewhat similar, except make it bigger. Expo 67 was a first-class World's Fair. There's a classes of World's Fairs, so it was at the highest level. It had 67 countries. Several countries would group together in one pavilion, so there was nearly 100 countries represented. All of those countries brought people to Expo 67. So it was quite a huge thing. You know, they built an island in the middle of the St. Lawrence and expanded another island to hold the fair. So it was a very, very large thing. I was in Montreal as well for the Olympics in 76, which was fun, a lot less innocent. The 76 Olympics followed both the October crisis in 1970 and the atrocity committed by Palestinian terrorists
in Munich.
The 72 Olympics. Yeah. So there were soldiers everywhere. Expo 67, although there was some security, it didn't have that feeling at all. It was quite a relaxed spirit for the most part.
And dignitaries, like De Gaulle famously came here, and Jackie Kennedy, or Jackie Onassis, I guess, at that point.
Yep, that's right.
And Robert Kennedy.
Bobby Kennedy was there with all but two or three of his children who were in university.
Yeah.
The list goes on. Haile Selassie was there. I mean, just an incredible list of Princess Grace of Monaco, of celebrities, both from movies and world leaders came. Quite an incredible number. The Queen famously toured Expo, took the monorail. And for security, they didn't announce where she would be. And then there's these wonderful photos of people on the ground pointing up and pointing at the Queen, who's waving back at them.
Yeah.
They're surprised to see her there. Haile Selassie notoriously came and wouldn't leave. He was supposed to visit Expo one day, and he had such a good time he wouldn't leave, which was fine with the Expo 67 people, the protocol people. The one problem is that he also brought his dog, Lulu. And so somebody had to be assigned to take care of Lulu. So they lost one of their staffers from the protocol office for, you know, a whole week to take care of Lulu the dog.
This is De Gaulle's visit was the famous one where he says Vive le Québec libre, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So he's at just before he's supposed to have the visit to Expo 67. He's in Montreal, and of course, for younger people or people who aren't into history, they might not remember that De Gaulle was he's described as the great liberator of occupied France. Certainly was a very brave man in the face of Vichy France and the occupation of his home country. Regarded as a liberator and fairly well regarded in Quebec. And then he, as you mentioned, goes to Montreal City Hall and he makes this speech, which is worth seeing on YouTube. He says, "Vive le Québec," and there's a cheer, and then he says, "Vive le Québec libre," you know, "long live a free Quebec," and the separatists in the crowd go nuts.
Yeah.
Of course, Lester Pearson is offended. You know, you don't come to my country as a guest and encourage Quebec separatism. There's a debate amongst historians about how much he knew what he was up to, but, you know, De Gaulle was a troublemaker, and so after that, he wasn't kicked out of the country, but Pearson decided that he wasn't going to escort him through the expo grounds like he did for most dignitaries, so De Gaulle spent a day where he was not lauded and celebrated as the great hero that he conceived himself to be, and then quietly left.
Yeah. So how much of all this Canadian fervor in this year of 1967, how much of that do you think was in response to the growing sovereignty movement in Quebec? And I'm wondering if it really worked, because after 68, you know, you mentioned the October crisis a couple of years, 3 years later, and the rise of the PQ and Lévesque. I mean, did it? I guess it worked for a bit.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. The bigotry of English Canada going into 1967 was the Frenchies will never pull this off.
Mm.
They can't do it. They're not accomplished enough. This is going to be a disaster, and it's going to make us look bad. There's a lot of stuff not usually said quite that baldly, but in some cases, yes, saying that that was going to be the case. For Quebec itself, Expo 67 was a great flourishing of our particular architects and graphic designers and mechanical engineers and other designers, all of whom got to work on the Expo project. It was a huge success. Architecturally, it was fascinating. Lots of things were tried. Mm-hmm. The one that most famously lasts, although it didn't influence the world as people thought in 1967, was Habitat. Moshe Safdie's design for pre-built residential living of apartment blocks,
right,
kind of stacked up like Legos. Of course, I'm just staying across here from the library, and he designed that one as well.
Yeah.
So there was this great flourishing for Quebec, and I think Quebec thought, the people that thought that Quebec could be independent had a realization. You know, we can be our own. We are a nation, and the question is, are we going to be a nation within Canada, or are we going to be a nation on our own? And that is a debate that continued and continues to this day in Quebec. The violence of the handful of people that were involved in the FLQ, they essentially unofficially called a halt during Expo 67. There were no FLQ incidents.
Mm-hmm.
They afterwards resumed their pathetic campaign of violence. So in some ways, Expo 67 did promote a feeling amongst Quebecois that they could achieve great things and they could be their own nation. But again, even within Quebec, they've never managed to have the 50% of people agreeing with that at any time when they're having a vote.
Mm.
But there was a flourishing for sure of Quebec nationalism coming out of Expo 67.
Yeah. Well, it must have been fun writing this book, was it?
Oh yeah, it was an absolute thrill. You know, jogging my childhood memories, and then seeing things I didn't know or had forgotten, and then as well trying to track people down. I managed to track down Hank Gallant in Pond Inlet, Prince Edward Island. There's a lot of Gallants in Prince Edward Island, let me tell you. So it took a few phone calls to get him. He was surprised that I was interested, which was great. I'm happy, and I hope he gets a bit more attention for his great feat.
Yeah,
it was just a hoot. You know, it was a fun year, and people, for the most part, had happy memories. And even as I'm on the book tour, people are coming up and saying, oh, yeah, my dad told me this, or my mom remembers doing that, and we went to Expo. So it's happy nostalgia in some ways.
And you mentioned the book tour. I mean, you've traveled a lot of these last couple of weeks, right?
Just got back from St. John's, Newfoundland, my first time on the far east coast, my 10th province now that I've managed to visit. Had a great reception there. Went to the book launch was in a place called the Crow's Nest Officers Club, which is a spectacular historical building filled with memorabilia, or it's not probably the right word, items from ships that were engaged in the Second World War. So it was great, and I've been in Toronto, and today, tonight, Vancouver, and we earlier had a launch at Munro's Books in Victoria, which I know you know well, and where I work, and it was great to have a celebration like that with my co-workers and family and friends.
It must be something to work at a place and see your book there.
Yeah, it's especially when, because, you know, it's kind of cheating because we did have an event and we sold a lot of copies. So then my book got moved to the front of the the paperback nonfiction bestseller list for the store. So that was a pretty proud moment, I have to admit.
Yeah. This year it's 50 years since the 100th anniversary. So we're essentially celebrating the 150th anniversary of this country. Are you surprised that there isn't the sort of the celebrations that there ought to be, perhaps?
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. The sesquicentennial, which is a word I like to use, and
is that what they call
it? What it means? Yeah, it means 150th. Celebrations are just not going to be the same. I think there was an opportunity there for the federal government to perhaps have done some capital works, could have built some buildings, could have done some highways, could have done those kind of things, could have done some things towards education, could have done some things in regards to First Nations and our relationship with First Nations. First Nations and Métis and Inuit peoples are pushing for that now, late as the year progresses, and I think we should listen to their voices and engage in the conversation. So I think in many ways it's been a missed opportunity. There's going to be celebration, especially on Canada Day, and that'll be fun, but I think there was a good chance for us to, you know, take a pause and look and reflect and see what we'd accomplished and get ready for the next steps. You know, I'm hoping that Canada becomes a world technology leader in a number of fields, especially computing and those areas, and it would be good to see the government encouraging that in whatever way is possible, through tax laws or employment or however is possible. So there are some, you know, there's still opportunities, and the year isn't done. We'll see we'll see if there are any legacies from, you know, 2017, as there are and that we still enjoy from 1967.
Yeah. A lot of my Tory friends on Facebook and such are lamenting that there isn't a 150 medal, you know, like they did it. They had a centennial medal, obviously, and then they had one at 125 in 92.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it. I don't know why there isn't, you know, for people who are listening and not familiar with those are medals that they could be, you know, a committee usually
decorations, right?
Yeah, decorations to honor people, Canadians, for their good works and their good deeds. Yeah, that would have been so there was one in centennial year. It's in the book. There were some things that didn't work out so well with it. They're pretty funny stories. I won't give them up now. People could check it out if they're interested. And also the Order of Canada was introduced in 1967, which is the highest civilian honor. So there were many opportunities I think missed here. Opportunities as well. You mentioned your Tory friends. Opportunities to engage monarchists in the country. The Queen has always had a really close, a lot of affection from Canadians towards the Queen, even those who aren't monarchists. She is, of course, approaching the end of her reign. And this would have been a good final opportunity to honor her and this long relationship. Nah, you know, missed opportunity. So it's too bad that foresight wasn't there 3 or 4 years ago.
What's next for you? Are you working on another book now?
I there's a couple of book ideas that we're kicking around. One project I've been working on a long time that we'll proceed with is there's a baseball collector in Seattle named Dave Eskenazi who has an incredible collection of photographs of baseball in Vancouver from the 19th century to current times. And I'm probably going to write the words to go along with that. And we're still debating the format, whether it should mostly be a picture book or should it be a history, a people's history with lots of photos. So, but that's one that's coming along, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at the notes here, and it's been 5 years since the previous one, Deadlines.
Right.
I'm surprised it's taken so long for a second book. Well, you had one in between, didn't you?
I did a project for the University of Victoria Athletics Department.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite book length, but a nice project that they had. I work full time, Joe.
Yeah.
It's hard to find the time. Yeah. I wish there was money to be, you know, my joke, I work at Monroe's, so I sell books every day, and my joke is I took up book writing because it's the only thing I could find that pays less than book selling.
But the book business is doing well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Books are doing very well. They've survived,
and
people want to read in hard copy, so.
And that's a good. Great place where you work. I went in there once about a year ago. And, man, I was telling someone, I can't remember who it was now, you walk into that place, and it's a store, right? It's an old bank that's turned into a store. But, I mean, there's a feeling that you get walking in there. I mean, this is something more than just a shop.
Yeah, oh, no, it's a wonderful, it's a temple, mm-hmm. a temple to the printed word.
I just thought it was great fun to walk in there every day to work there.
It is, it is, Joe. And the best part is people like you who come along. You know, you're extremely well read, and then you, for you to see what's on the shelves, to ask, you know, what's happening, what's new, what's exciting. We get that every day, and I started there just less than 2 years ago, and thought I knew a lot about books. I know nothing about books. There's a lot of books out there. You know, people. You know, I think I know something, and somebody comes in, they need a self-help book or a psychology book, and. Home decorating book, and I realized, okay, I don't know as much as I think I do. Yeah. Don't you want a book on the Second World War? I can help you with that. So every day is a learning experience, and we often learn from the customers who will tell us about what they've read and what they liked and what they didn't. And so it's quite a fun, you know, for a retail job, it's quite a good one.
Yeah, I was in Victoria about a month or so ago, earlier this month, and I'm really due for a visit because I went there very briefly last year. Saw you.
Joe, I can remember seeing you. We had, it was the book sale, the Times Columnist book sale.
And yeah.
It was also Authors for Indies Day.
Yeah.
And the store was very chaotic. I do remember you, dapper as always. You were very well dressed for a guy who was about to rummage through thousands of used books at the book sale.
Yeah, well, it's a great sale, and I must spend more time at Monroe's. Before we go, what I enjoyed about this book, your book, The Year Canadians Lost Their Minds and Found Their Country, was just how nice it looked. The colors, awfully nostalgic, they really pop off the page.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. Yeah, Douglas and McIntyre hired a designer by the name of Diane Robertson to do that, and she did a really great job. I think she captured the spirit of the book and the spirit of 1967. It's kind of got laugh-in lettering for people who haven't seen the book. Kind of not quite psychedelic, but kind of groovy and fun.
Yeah. Well, it's a very fine achievement, Tom, and you're to be commended for giving this year to the rest of us and for future generations. Congratulations on it. It's always fun to talk, and I'll see you at Monroe soon.
Oh, I can't wait to see you again, Joseph.
The book is called The Year Canadians Lost Their Minds and Found Their Country, The Centennial of 1967. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Tom Hawthorne, its author, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.